This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a news and information consumer, you are a witness to the fall of legacy media. Magazines folding, record and movie companies battling piracy, the rise of cheap reality TV shows, and print media circling the drain. In the 3 years after 2008, newspapers cut 40,000 jobs, unleashing hordes of freelance writers to compete in the information economy. Former LA Times arts reporter Scott Timberg was among those let go. Casualties, we are told, of shifting technological, social, and economic trends. In a series of essays for Salon, Timberg detailed something much deeper and far-reaching in creative destruction, an ongoing assault on the creative class that he argues has been underway since long before file sharing or the iPhone. Those essays are compiled in a new book called The Culture Crash. And Scott Timberg, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
In this book, you make it clear that the creative class is not just the writers and the musicians and the actors or creators of culture, but those that you call their often mocked supporting casts. Like who?
Well, the part of the supporting cast that's most important to me is people who engage directly with people curious about books and music and movies. So I'm talking about a group that used to be much larger, which is bookstore and record store and video store clerks and it's funny, I don't know the scene in New Hampshire, but since the mid-90s, we've added about 60 million people to the U.S. economy, and we have about half as many independent bookstores as we had back then. Mm-hmm. So the numbers of these people are declining. They're an important part of it. People who work in these places have committed themselves to being around this stuff. You know, they love books, they love music, they love movies. But the creative class is broad and complex. I mean, a sound engineer at a radio station is part of it. The manager for a musician is in this group too, and everything in between. And you're absolutely right. It's not just the creators themselves. It's also, again, journalists, especially journalists who write about music or art or something, are very much parts of the creative class and exposed to the same tensions and sort of threats that the rest of the creative class is exposed to.
There's a lot of despair and hand-wringing over disappearing sectors of the American economy when you look at, you know, sort of rural agrarian economies or, you know, manufacturing plants in middle America. But there's not a lot of love for the unemployed record store clerk, right? Or bookstore clerk.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is where you're going with this. I mean, one of the things that I wanted to figure out is how come as Americans we sort of assume that, you know, industry, like say, you know, I'm from Baltimore, so I remember when steel started to fade out, and the sort of sense that something valuable was being lost, and you know, there are big concerts when farmers suffer. You know, we have a sense that sort of the agrarian economy is the roots of the American character or something. But you know, the creative output, whether it's again novels, movies, music, graphic design. This is sort of what America does best, and it's employed an enormous number of people. But somehow, as you say, we don't see this as a real threat to our identity. We don't see this as a group that we need to save. And there's all kinds of reasons for it. I mean, part of it is that at least since Dan Quayle and Newt Gingrich, there's been a sense that the cultural elite, which is what people who work in the arts or culture have been tarred with, are not, you know, real Americans. You know, not only are they not worthy of sympathy, there's something sort of seditious about them. And it was a great term for the financial class. It meant you could be a billionaire banker in a gated community and you could call a jazz musician or a guy who wrote about art for the newspaper an elitist. You know, the wealthy were no longer the elitist. It was people who liked classical music or people who were into novels or something.
Well, you also point to the internet and smartphones, you know, needing free content as part of the cause for this, but that the devaluing of the arts and humanities has been going on for much longer. What are some of the root causes?
Well, that's a really important part of this. I mean, we had a sense, you know, we in sort of the West, Europe, the States, you know, a sense that the arts were this sort of window into truth or sort of a path into the soul, that whether it was music or poetry or the novel or whatever, that they were essential to our lives. There was wisdom involved. They were transforming. You know, museums were built that looked like temples. You know, there was in the sort of late 19th, early 20th century, there was what you could call sort of culture worship. And there was a sense that there was something very sacred about this stuff. In the mid-century, there was a spreading of high culture to a mass audience, which was extremely important. But then at some point, we started to think about culture in a different way. You had sort of simultaneously Andy Warhol sort of tweaking the seriousness of it and saying that it wasn't really all that important as we thought. You also had what I call market worship startups so in the 70s and 80s, so that if something didn't generate an enormous amount of wealth, there must be something wrong with it. In other words, if your symphony orchestra in your town needs public funding, that clearly it's failed. You know, everything's a business now, and if it can't make it, it's a failure. Mm-hmm. So there were all kinds of shifts in the way we viewed arts and culture. So we used to call it culture, which at least had a sort of resonance to it. Now we call it content, and what happened in between is hard to figure out, but it's crucial to where we are now.
We're speaking with a one-time newspaper arts reporter, Scott Timberg, about his new book called Culture Crash. And this is about how sweeping economic changes are actually endangering the artists and the writers and the musicians and the creative class in America. Well, you also point to self-inflicted wounds, you know, that members of the creative class have had a lot to do with the its own destruction. Now, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, there was a sense of purpose, I think, to people who worked in the world of culture, and this includes, say, you know, English professors who pass the torch on to young people. It's true of artists like Warhol. There started to be an idea in the 60s and 70s that arts and culture were not holy, but were rather, you know, something that came out of class relations, or they were sort of an expression of power. And all this stuff came together to kind of dethrone the notion that there was something transcendent about culture. If you look at if you look these days at coverage of, say, visual art in almost every newspaper or mainstream media institution, it's all about the auction prices that the painting got, last night in London or New York or something. This is not the way this stuff was covered in the 50s and 60s, you know, when there was more of a sense that the arts were sort of a window to the soul or a means of transcendence. The creative class spreads the idea to other people about what this stuff means. So if you have, for instance, Warhol telling you that art is just what sells and that mass production is the same as something handmade, after a while, if people start to hear that, they're going to start to wonder, well, why should I consume this stuff, be interested in this stuff, if I could just make more money working on Wall Street?
So that is the loss of culture as sacred cow. But of course, there is also the internet. You know, this rapacious need for new content, I'm going to use that term, has created a competitive freelance economy. What are the drawbacks of that?
Well, as somebody who had a job or various jobs for 15 years and has been a freelancer for six or so, you know, there's this whole sort of gospel that being free and self-branding and going it alone and so on will make everybody, you know, every sort of creative figure healthier, richer, more robust. There are a few people who managed to make it in the new sort of relentless, you know, internet economy. Every person who does make it, by the way, writes a book on it, and you hear about them incessantly about how we live in this sort of great new world where creative people can take the reins themselves. For the vast majority of us, and I'm luckier than most, I wrote for fairly big publications and I'm established in my field. But even somebody at my level and lots of others are struggling to live in American cities as rents and cost of living, even in a recession and a feeble economy, skyrocket. So it's, you know, there's a sort of greater freedom. You can define yourself, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to write 24 hours a day, there's a place to put it. If the issue here, though, is making a living as a musician, a writer, graphic designer, architect, whatever, if the issue is being a full-fledged member of the creative class who can live like a middle-class person, things are not going in the right direction.
Yeah. So you're presenting this idea of an age when only the wealthy can be artists, or the average dancer in America is making $15,000 a year. Do you see a day when culture is a luxury good?
I think that's where we're headed. I mean, you know, people who don't read my books, you know, say things like, oh, you know, there's this guy who thinks that art is going to just suddenly stop, you know, which isn't my argument. You know, my argument is that when artists and craftsmen can't make a living, we all pay the price. And I think that's where we're headed, is to a world in which musicians, artists, writers, et cetera, aren't making money from their work. They're making money because they have an inheritance or because they have a trust fund or they're struggling, like most of the people I know, or they decide, you know, I love this stuff and I care about it. I can't do it. I'm dropping out. Those are the things I'm seeing. And again, in being involved in the arts and culture, I don't mean being a full-time classical composer, say, but I mean being involved at some level, whether you're working at a bookstore, whether you're, you know, helping a musician as a publicist. You know, if middle-class people can't get involved in this stuff, we don't really have a real culture anymore. We have kind of a plutocracy.
Well, Scott Tinberg, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for your interest.
Scott Tinberg is a former arts reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's now an L.A.-based culture writer and contributing writer for Salon. You'll find more on his book, Culture Crash, How Sweeping Economic Changes Are Imperiling Artists, Writers, and Musicians in America. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. My So-Called Life, Freaks and Geeks, Arrested Development, all celebrated TV shows that fans and critics argue were canceled too soon. Up next, a TV critic urges us to take pleasure in shows that have been given the axe prematurely. The case for necro-streaming when Word of Mouth continues.